So good afternoon. Unfortunately, Dr. Sterritt cannot be with us at the moment. She'll join us later because she's teaching at the moment. So I think she'll join us at 3:30. Lawrence, you can be in contact with her. So it's a great pleasure and honor to receive the visit of Robert McNamee. He's long been interested in the possibilities of relating texts and computers, and he's worked in several projects in the digital humanities, including medieval authors like Chaucer and modern literature as well. And he's now director of the Electronic Enlightenment Project at Oxford. Electronic Enlightenment may be a unique instance in the humanities. It's now part of the Bodleian Libraries. While its published result, Electronic Enlightenment, then is now distributed worldwide through Oxford University Press. So thank you very much, Robert, for giving this lecture on this fascinating project.
Right. Thank you for coming. And thanks for hosting me in your beautiful city. I've never been here before, and I've enjoyed it very much. My apologies to Mary Madeleine and Francoise, because they've seen some of this before last week, and I was at the Sorbonne at a meeting hosted by Mary Madeleine. The username and password on here will be good to the end of December. If you read my odd biographical note, you'll know that I have a perhaps unusual background, having begun in astrophysics. In those days when computer programs were punch tapes and punch cards, and the project I was working on was studying the Aurora Borealis, and the signal would come down to the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and they would put it onto a punch tape and then put it on a Greyhound bus, and it would travel for 5 days to the west coast of North America so we could do something with it. But I have always been interested in computers and texts. And I went back after taking off 8 years to go skiing. I went back, and that's relevant because it gave me a business background as well as an academic background. I went back to study literature at Oxford with one of the world's great bibliographic and textual scholars, Don McKenzie. And I had the idea that, as I was always interested in letters, and because at Oxford I still attended out of interest some of the advanced lectures in physics to see what was going on, I heard a talk by a young physicist who'd come back from CERN, which was Tim Berners-Lee, telling us about this idea he had for an internet web functionality with hypertext and so on. And I thought that made sense in terms of letters and the interconnectedness of correspondence in earlier centuries. So I worked on the idea for a couple of years, and through a variety of fortuitous events, I ended up being offered a research post at the Voltaire Foundation in Oxford, which most of you may know is a center mainly for the study of the French 18th century. But among other things, they publish vast collections of correspondence, Voltaire and Rousseau most notably, but many others, and they continue to publish those today. And I realized that what we had the opportunity to do was to recreate this first global network of communication. And while it seemed ambitious to call it that at the time, since then, the various letters and interconnectivities we've been able to demonstrate make it quite accurate. The project is based initially on best scholarly print editions. We needed something to get it started, as it were, but my ambition was always to include what we've come to call born digital content, material that is produced by academics directly for publication in Electronic Enlightenment. And we ended up being asked by the Mellon Foundation to apply for a grant. We ended up getting 6 in total. And in fact, we're about to get a 7th sometime in 2015 to work on something I'll tell you about a little bit later. What they really understood was the digitization of content, and they gave us a lot of money to digitize content. I've still got something like 20,000 letters on this computer that haven't been put on the web yet, because we had to keep digitizing content, even though we were spending a lot of our time working on the technical and bibliographical detail of what lies behind it. Currently, we have over 70 existing scholarly editions, and I have a little annotation that says important citation implications. Interestingly, I've discovered that scholars using Electronic Enlightenment still cite, if there's a book, they cite the book, not the edition. Big mistake, because what's online in Electronic Enlightenment does not match what's in the book. We've made thousands of corrections and alterations to the data. One of the things that digitizing and parsing and cross-checking does is it allows you to discover all kinds of problems with faulty annotations, for instance. In addition, we've added significant annotations where information from other sources or from scholars writing to us have been able to fill in information that wasn't in the original. So if people are citing the book when they're actually quoting something from Electronic Enlightenment, they're actually doing something they shouldn't be doing in scholarly terms. All the material is full text XML. And because of my bibliographic background, we've got an obsessive quantity of detail. Currently, we've got, I think there's 20 presses listed here who provide content to us. And most of them actually send me books. Cambridge sent me a volume just recently of letters saying, can you put this on your shelf for a couple of years because we want to sell books? Then go ahead and put it into Electronic Enlightenment. The material that is provided by scholarly editors or scholarly presses, we pay a license fee. So we actually give them something in return for the material. But as I mentioned, we're getting increasing quantities of born digital material. We're just completing a major edition of Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, which has never been in print before. Frederick the Great, we already have some 800 or 900 letters of Frederick the Great in Electronic Enlightenment, but one of my colleagues at Oxford recently discovered some Frederick the Great letters in the Bodleian Library. Somebody knew they were there probably once upon a time. But the Harcourt family papers, major aristocratic family, lived in and around Oxford, friends with Rousseau, produced several prime ministers and chancellors of the exchequer, etc. 2 years ago, they provided all of their family's correspondence dating from the late 1500s to the Bodleian Library in lieu of taxes. And I've been gradually working on that material. Elizabeth Montagu, I'm on an editorial board of a project which is looking to edit her letters, most of which exist in the Huntington Library in California. I'm just finishing, while I'm here, an application for funding to the Arts and the HRC, the Arts Research and in Humanities Council, I guess it is now. They keep changing the name. But to have this material imaged, it will then go, the images will go into Electronic Enlightenment, the images of the manuscripts, and we'll use a transcription tool we're developing for students and particularly graduate students to work in the transcribing process. Voltaire's up here. Nicholas Kronk and I, Nicholas Kronk is the director of the Voltaire Foundation. We've been able to identify something approaching 200 letters that weren't in the Bestemann edition, one group of which were purchased by the New York Public Library on our behalf at Sotheby's recently, and provided to us for inclusion in Electronic Enlightenment. And one of the ones I find quite interesting is the Barton family, the second item on the list. A family in Hampshire had inherited a box of correspondence from their grandmother. They took it to Southampton University, which is their nearest university, and they said to come to Oxford and see me. And it's an extraordinary collection running from 1700 to 1918, includes letters to and from some of the great families in England. Nobody's seen this material outside of the family before. So that material is about to go live in EE. There's an exchange of, we're this week, in fact, my colleague Mark, who works with me, will be putting online the Claire Claremont correspondence. We have the Mary Wollstonecraft in the works, but an academic at was at Durham, now at Oxford, has found a group of letters from Laura Galloni, who is the daughter of a friend of Mary Wollstonecraft's. So that material is going in. The idea is we're constantly expanding material, sometimes single letters, sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of letters. David Hume, there's been 60 letters discovered of David Hume's, which will be going in next year. I use Adam Smith as a good example. We have the 1982 OUP edition. We've gathered individual letters from journals, Scottish, German, American, English journals. And the editor of the original edition has provided me with 20 more letters, which he's discovered. So increasingly, electronic enlightenment becomes the only place where you can see the latest state of a collection of a person's letters. These numbers are actually a little bit out of date. It's now just about 20 or 30 letters under 70,000 online as of the end of this week. And the date range is also wrong. We now have letters from 1600 to 1918. At the Bestemann lecture a week and a half ago, there was a discussion about, it was a presentation by Professor Wally about the German Enlightenment, and the discussion turned on whether the word Enlightenment should have a capital E or a little e, and ours very much should actually have a little e because we extend it significantly beyond the main period. We have 11 languages in total. As you can see, English, French, German, and Italian are the primary languages, but we do have secondary languages. Everything's captured as Unicode, so it is actually searchable if you know how to key in the right characters on your keyboard. We have an increasing number of translations, and I'm just starting a project with a group who will use graduate students in graduate translation programs to begin translating the material in electronic enlightenment. We've already done it with 1,000 or more letters. But the idea is eventually to have this material as accessible in as many languages as possible. The material also undergoes scholarly annotation. So that in itself is an extraordinary resource. But one of the things we're gradually doing is we're connecting the annotations together so that if there's a reference to John Locke's cousin in one source, that material is available in other materials, that relevant materials that come into electronic enlightenment. Thousands of manuscript references. Last month I spent a considerable amount of time changing 3,500 manuscript references because the Bodleian and the British Library had recatalogued a group of manuscripts, and we keep up to date on that sort of material. The printed sources, that's early printed editions of correspondence, and we're looking to tie that to online catalogs. There are problems because many of the catalogs, including the Library of Congress, which runs a master list of name authorities, does not correct their entries. If the entries are proven to be wrong, they expect you to use the wrong entry, so we can't make automatic matching between them. Multiple nationalities, multiple occupations. There's everything from ballet masters to forgers and early obstetricians to farmers and trike merchants. We've got an interesting collection from Paris of trike merchants. Everything in electronic enlightenment is treated as a digital object. And if I can just back out of here for a second. Everything is captured, as I say, in XML. Oh. Why is it not showing my screen? Any thoughts? Probably something in the mirroring, right?
Yeah, you have to arrangements. I suppose mirror displays.
Last. Sorry about that. So while everything is keyed in XML, it ends up going into a series of 50 related databases. The databases run in size from a matter of 100K to a gigabyte in size. Everything is broken down into multiple elements so that you could find every letter that appears on the 212th page of an edition published in 1910. I don't know why you would want to, but we treat, as I say, everything as a digital object. Back to where I was. One of the problems we often run across is I have some 200 editions of correspondence on my bookshelf, and every one of them differs in some way. And we try and smooth them out because it doesn't make any sense. If you come into a project like Electronic Enlightenment through a search mechanism, you may land in the middle of a string of correspondence that to the editor who worked on it made sense in a linear fashion, but doesn't make sense to you because you'll have it grouped with other materials from other other sources. So we try to smooth out things. Alphanumeric note calls, for instance, the Rousseau edition, mainly because Ralph Lee, who was at Cambridge and was being published by the Voltaire Foundation, and they didn't like he didn't like Bestemann, and Bestemann didn't like him. And if you look in the annotations to the Rousseau and Voltaire editions, you'll find some wonderful name-calling where they attack each other violently at times. But Lee gave textual annotations, numbers, unlike every other edition, and critical annotations, letters, so that we end up in the Rousseau edition with 236 Z by the time you go through the alphabet, 236 times in one letter. So we've had to alter all of those. So we go through that sort of work. We have thousands of references when we're inputting material to BL. Now, for most scholars, BL means the British Library. But for one edition of some 4,000 letters, they used it for the Bodleian Library. And for the Boyle edition, they used it for an edition of the Boyle Letters. So we also expand all abbreviations in Electronic Enlightenment. Again, you can't be expecting people, when they land on a document through a search, to have to go off and find what some annotation, or sorry, some abbreviation means in the process. We also deal with the dating of materials based on geographical location. We've built a matching table of calendars for the Julian, Gregorian, and the French Revolutionary that run from 1500 to 2100. Can be expanded, make allowances for leap years, etc. But we also make allowances for the fact that the dates changed by geographical region. All the documents are given a Gregorian date to give them a chronological sequence that's consistent, but with every one of them, there's also provided a Julian date and a French Revolutionary, if that's relevant. Again, distinguishing people, we spend enormous amounts of time trying to distinguish people, trying to match people. In a printed edition, or even for our born digital scholars who are creating something directly for Electronic Enlightenment, this has been particularly true with the Bernardin de Saint-Pierre correspondence, there's a lot of obscure people in that correspondence, relatively obscure people. In print, you can say, I don't know who this is. You can say, this Joe Bloggs is probably the cousin of James Bloggs, but I'm not sure. In Electronic Enlightenment, each person is the center and the node, the knot at the beginning of their own web of correspondence. So we have to identify these people. And it's one of the places where the development of the internet and Google's mass digitization of books particularly 19th century books, has been hugely helpful because it's been easier for us to search through this material and find instances. But having said that, we don't always get it right. And we have emails arriving all the time from people who say, that's my great-great-great-grandmother, and I know something about them. And I email back right away and say, great, can you write a biographical note about them? And we credit people with those annotations. We make links to and from the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. 1,460 doesn't seem like many, perhaps, but of course, they're only listing famous and important people. We have many, many, many of the more interesting sort of ordinary people. And we're adding the Library of Congress name authority links, but as I say, it's incredibly complicated because their records are, in many cases, wrong. So we have to match corrections to the wrong. We give place name locations in modern English as a searchable tool, but behind the scenes, there's a growing table of variations for place names. We have a relationship with the Getty Research Center in California, who've been putting together, latest count, 2.5 million geographical locations in a standardized listing that gives their coordinates so they can be found in digital mapping systems. And we're providing them with a lot of variants on the place names. Obviously, you can browse. I'll disconnect and plug into the Electronic Enlightenment in a minute on the other laptop. You can browse, you can search. There's citation exportation. Content growth goes up. We add in the neighborhood of 3,500 to 4,500 documents a year, which is a huge amount of work. Probably 300 to 500 new individuals. Sometimes not even new. Sometimes I was working last night in my hotel room, and I discovered that one of the people that somebody referred to by a particular name, it was a slang form of the name, as it turned out, and it was somebody we already had in Electronic Enlightenment. We're about to add the Barton family letters that I mentioned. The Bernardin de Saint-Pierre, we've got another 500 and some letters, leaving only a few left out of the complete collection. We're adding 6 volumes of Piozzi letters. I don't like that edition. They abbreviated everybody's name. But guess what? Over the course of 6 volumes, they didn't use the same abbreviation for the same people. And there are some abbreviations that don't appear in their list of expansions. So that was a lot of work. The Richard Price edition, which is quite interesting, is a nice little cluster of letters between Richard Price and Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson has made arrangements for the sculptor Houdon to go to North America to do a statue of George Washington, which now exists in the State Capitol building in Richmond, Virginia. And he's interested in insuring him because Houdon wants a whole lot of money and up front. Before he travels. And Jefferson wants some sort of insurance. And Richard Price was the man who helped invent modern insurance and helped set up the Equitable Insurance Company. One of the things we've done around this is we've added some material from other sources to flesh that out. And then also the Thomas Warton, which is, he was professor of poetry at Oxford and key in the 18th century in developing Oxford University Press into the vast and mighty publishing business it is. So, among the other things that we're doing, I worked with a colleague at Stanford, and we're about to make application to Oxford University Press has a pool of significant amount of money that they use for interesting projects. And we're making application next week with the new professor of visualization at Oxford to work with Stanford and Yale on some interesting visualizations of the data. But this is the first sample. Sound.
Stanford University.
That we did with Stanford.
Here we have
a snapshot of all of the data that we have collected so far. This is data that comes entirely from the Electronic Enlightenment Project. But this project, what we're trying to do is use new computer technology and geographical imaging in order to create maps of the Republic of Letters and that show not only how these networks intermingle, but also how they evolve over time. What's really remarkable about this period and about the Republic?
Great, okay. So much for that. One of the things we've done with Stanford, the development of that particular visualization tool took a weekend. One of the benefits of working with Stanford is they have this amazing humanities computing department filled with young people who are dead keen to do something with lots of data. And one of the things that we have is lots and lots of data. Now, these should give us an example of, within Electronic Enlightenment, I looked up Aix-en-Provence, and when I see we've got 21 letters and documents to or from Aix-en-Provence, because we're not connected to the internet, I can't show you that, the map itself. But the one letter that I selected was from the Reverend Denis Grenville, who is Archbishop of York, who is supported James II in England, and when James II was driven out, he fled to France. And he's decided to winter in Aix because they've been introduced to a Dr. Bruchier. And Reverend Grenville's sister is perhaps a bit of a hypochondriac, but certainly seems to be ill all the time. And he has something terrible to say about Aix and then something nice. So it doesn't sound to me like he really knows much about it at all. He says, we tend to swallow down the many inconvenience occasioned here by bigotry and dearness of the country and want of English, which we could not endure had we not so good an ally, that is the doctor. Though I must confess, to be just to Aix, the town is very fine and our treatment very good. So somewhat inconsistent. If I log on here, one of the things we do is create family trees for people to try and distinguish and differentiate who people are. This is the Barton family. Turns out one of the members of the family, Catherine Conduit, who is Nate Barton, married John Conduit, and Catherine was favorite niece of Isaac Newton, so we've been able to make interesting connections from a less well-known member of the family, filling out more information about the famous scientist. As I say, everything goes into Electronic Enlightenment in a sequence of databases with every bit of information broken down into tables. The material is then, if I go to an associated, we're in the process right now of doing thematic categorization of all of the documents as well, which means reading all the documents. The material is output into an XML format then, which goes into a MySQL database for delivery on the web. Sorry, trying to find, there we are. So we have very high quality maps. All the imaging we do is archival quality imaging. It'll take it a minute to resolve that. And then the material is all tiled as you get in Google Maps so that you have seamless presentation across the images. There's that image of revolutionary Paris. Oh, doesn't want to blow up anymore. we're beginning to put in images of people. Sorry. A very young Alexander Pope. Oxford has the largest collection of portraiture outside of the National Portrait Gallery. And there's been a project gradually photographing the images. Most of them are hidden away in the colleges or places like the Bodleian Library in the back hallways and so on. So people don't usually get to see them. But one of the projects, associated projects that we're going to be working on is at the Ashmolean Museum. They have 200,000 uncatalogued engravings of famous people from the 1500s to the end of the 1900s. Sorry, that's you. So material that comes from print sources we scan. The scans are sent to India, keyed at 99.98% accuracy. Double keyed, in fact. This is a letter from the Earl of Stanhope's aunt. Doesn't sound very sympathetic. She says, "I'm almost dead, having been up all night with my sister, who is this minute brought to bed with a son and daughter. And I hope she is like to do well." She goes on to complain about having a headache over the whole thing. It wasn't her who was giving birth. A colleague in Germany recently discovered in this 1796 printing two letters to Voltaire, which were known about but had never been seen outside of this printed edition. Are we logged on here? Oh, sorry. 2014, wrong keyboard. One of the problems with visualizations is you can produce what look like pretty results, but they don't really mean a great deal. In fact, there was somebody who wrote a paper based on the animated visualization that Stanford did for us, saying that because of that, they could see that John Locke had never written a letter to a specific location. But of course, it was a selected group of documents that were in the visualization. Sorry,
are you able to get on? Yeah,
thank you. Excellent.
I also found the links for the various letters in Aix-en-Provence.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I found the link.
Yes.
Yeah, I can show you if you want.
Do you want to?
Yeah.
We're unusual because we produce a result that is sold, and I know that's painful to some people, and everybody would like these things to be free. I'd like these things to be free, but somebody pays somewhere for something. And the Mellon Foundation funded us in part to see if we could create a project that was self-sustaining, because they were tired, exceedingly tired, of providing money to projects, thank you, that simply died. Even the British different councils that are funding humanities projects demand sustainability. But if you read the fine print, the sustainability only has to be 3 years long. I don't know what kind of sustainability that is. What happens is libraries like the Bodleian and the British Library end up with these materials given to them. And I've got a colleague who sits outside my office whose sole job is trying to keep thousands of projects, digital projects, alive. He has to update software. He has to update hardware to run the software to run the program that's been created. And the libraries are very unhappy with this because eventually it's costing them significant sums of money to keep this stuff alive. We do sell what we do. It maintains the project. We're now break even. We're self-supporting. And the university charges us for our space and for the accountants we use and for the administrative services of the university, etc., making us relatively unusual. And I haven't found another humanities project that actually pays its own way like that. And from next year, we'll be able to start funding our own additions to the project. So we'll begin a program of imaging more and more of the actual manuscripts, probably 2,000-3,000 a year to add to Electronic Enlightenment. Eventually, we do support students, graduate students, and one of the things I would like to suggest here is that if anyone is working on correspondence or knows of correspondence, whether it's a single letter or hundreds of letters, and I know at least one person I've been told is doing that, please consider being involved with Electronic Enlightenment. The project is non-exclusive. We don't exclude its appearance in any other format. Indeed, we'll help prepare material for print or what other format that needs to be done. We can produce electronic books if that's what somebody wants to do. The thing is, none of those methodologies, none of those output mechanisms will compete with Electronic Enlightenment because in EE, it's interconnected in the network of correspondence. And I used an example which our colleagues from the Sorbonne have heard already, but looking when the Icelandic volcano, which I won't attempt to name, went off a couple of years ago, I looked in EE, and sure enough, there's a whole cluster of letters about the same volcano erupting and the tens of thousands of people that died across Europe because of the nuclear winter effect that it created and the failure of crops. But in the course of it, I came across a discussion of how volcanoes probably work. And there's a great dispute going on through this correspondence about how volcanoes worked. And there was one accurate and detailed description of how it worked. And it was in the notes of the William Cooper, who's an English poet, in his correspondence. And if somebody's looking for an early reference on how volcanism actually works, they aren't likely to search in the letters of a poet. But that's one of the things you get in Electronic Enlightenment. You're quite surprised to discover where the information lies. And the more we provide, the more those kinds of discoveries may occur. One of our subscribers is the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine. They use it for looking up early references to medicine. Another one is the NASA's Ames Space Flight Center, which uses it for some of the early discussions of fluid dynamics that are in Boyle and other correspondence editions. So there are no limits to the kind of materials that can go in or that can fill in and make connections with other materials in Electronic Enlightenment. I think I've said more than enough. Perhaps people would like to ask some questions and...
Thank you very much for this illuminating presentation of the project. Actually, I did not realize that Enlightenment was not to be taken in its chronological sense. It's wider than the 18th century.
Much, much wider. It began with a capital E, Enlightenment, because I was working at the Voltaire Foundation, and they wanted that. It's also the reason why I took the project and left the Voltaire Foundation and went to the Bodleian Library. At a meeting of the fund committee, which runs the Voltaire Foundation, the chairman at the time suggested that we should change it to a lowercase e. I'm working on a project with a group in America who are looking at the sources of the American Constitution. And it's a group of constitutional lawyers who are particularly interested in how you use the discussions in Voltaire and Montesquieu and Locke, et cetera, to conceive of a constitution that makes sense for a country. And this has real-world implications because one of my colleagues who's working on this is advising Libya and Egypt on the creation of constitutions for those countries, not to take the American constitution as a model, which is typically American way of thinking of things, but to actually look at the materials in Electronic Enlightenment and in the documents or the books that these people wrote and go through the argument process about what kind of constitution you should create for these countries. So we're working on digitizing Benjamin Franklin's library, which still exists in the Library Company of Philadelphia, although it's dispersed throughout the building. If you can imagine having the actual library that Ben Franklin put together and was used by the delegates when they wrote the Constitution, and then just kind of losing track of it in the building. We actually have to catalog the whole library in detail to find these documents, but it's part of a project that Gates are interested in because we can build some educational tools. One of my reasons for building EE was, as a North American, I was tired of my peers thinking that somehow North America, and America in particular, just leapt into existence out of nothing. They like that mythology. But of course, it was built on ideas that were being discussed here in France and in Scotland and in England and so on.
So what are the limits of the spectrum, I mean, historically speaking?
None. I see this eventually being correspondence online, interconnected correspondence. As I say, at the moment, we've pushed back the boundaries. Yeah. I have to do it delicately at times, but I have colleagues in the English faculty who suggest Byron, so we're adding material there. And but the idea is eventually to look at how people shared ideas and argued ideas. When my daughter was in high school, she was taking a course in philosophy, and they were reading Descartes and finding it difficult. We've got Descartes' letters in Electronic Enlightenment, so I went in and did a presentation to the students, and one of the boys, typically teenage boys, sitting at the back of the room, I saw him sort of do this double take, and he put his hand up, and I said, "Yes, what would you like to say?" He said, "I got it." He said, "These people are just like us." And I thought, yes, that's enlightenment, you know, because if you pick up Descartes or you pick up Smith's Wealth of Nations or something like that as a young person and you try to read it, these people seem so other. They're so incredibly intelligent and so... But of course, if you look in the correspondence, you see them arguing with each other about the ideas and sometimes being really nasty to each other. Descartes would always include with his letters to Hobbes a note to Mersenne, who passed on the letters to Hobbes, and he called Hobbes, when he spoke to Mersenne, as that fat English slob. But he didn't say that to Hobbes, obviously. But you see these people as real human beings, struggling to understand what it is they're trying to say and trying to discover. So.
Thank you. Questions? Sorry. Maybe Françoise first.
Yes. I was fascinated to hear how much the Electronic Enlightenment, how much it has added on, and how much it has improved, if that is the right word. It's an 18th century word. Because the last time I heard you make the presentation, apart from last week, I think, was at the Graz Congress of 18th Century Studies, which was almost 4 years ago. And it's fascinating to see how much the project has improved, etc. As we were coming to Aix on the train, I had a conversation with my mom, and then I asked her whether the Bibliothèque de la Sorbonne subscribes, and she doesn't think it does. So I would have two stupid questions, which are, is it possible to know which French libraries have subscribed, or is that a secret, a commercial secret? And if we wanted to try and persuade our university libraries to subscribe, how much would they be asked to pay? And is it a subscription, or is it something that you buy for once? Could a scheme be set up whereby, you know, the only way that we were able to get Ebo and Echo years after the English everybody else was that we set up a kind of a national scheme that to allow it, each of our universities to have access to Ebo and Echo. So,
that's a lot of very good questions. I don't remember whether the Sorbonne subscribes or not. It is possible to buy access to Electronic Enlightenment as well. We've introduced...
As an individual?
You can get it as an individual, but an institution like the Sorbonne can purchase outright access to Electronic Enlightenment. There's a nominal annual hosting and update fee, because what they can't have is all the data to sit on their server. But trying to remember to take them in order, that it's not a secret who subscribes frankly, I don't know what the last list is, but I can find out. There aren't many institutions in France. Less than any other major country, probably. I think the idea of a national consortium is exactly right. That's what's happened in Germany. We've been taken on as part of a national consortium and institutions. And it's the same in the UK. An organization called JISC has purchased access to Electronic Enlightenment and is providing it to institutions. One of the reasons for wanting to get more institutions to subscribe is also to get, that way we get more people providing content and being involved in the enrichment and broadening and deepening of this vast collection of materials. The actual negotiations about purchasing, it's not hugely expensive, but I understand library budgets are constrained in terms of subscriptions. But the actual negotiations would involve Oxford University Press, because they have an agreement to manage that for us. I would be involved in that process, and if I knew people to contact here in France, I'd be more than happy to be part of that negotiation.
That was Gerard's moment. Maybe we could advertise this now.
Yes.
Shall we?
Yes, yes.
Sorry? There's free access for...
Yeah,
France.
Okay.
Sorry.
That free access is available to the end of December.
It says 27th of February.
Oh, maybe they did longer. Oh, good. Excellent.
That's 3 months.
Excellent. That's managed by OUP. I mean, one of our complications in dealing with OUP, I have to say, is the fact that we're very small, our team. Currently, there's only two of us. We're about to hire another member. We use students to help us in the progress, in the project. But one of our problems with OUP is it's so huge. They do things like in April, they announced that they were changing the authentication system, and it meant that we had to change our servers, the way the program's written, everything. So we've been working on that behind the scenes. So they're a bit difficult at times, but I think if we can approach them about this, this would be really important. I mean, we have so much French material.
Sorry, John, just to go on about the same thing. I think we advertised this event quite well, and if I'm not mistaken, there's nobody there from the French faculty, for instance, nor historians, nor people from the Russian, Polish, Slavic department, etc., etc.
Just
so, as a point, if we go to bibliothèque or even as a university, then and as ambitious, and because this is a project called Electronic Enlightenment Based in Oxford, that you have no chance to be heard. But what we need to do is try to go there with other people, obviously for all the other departments, philosophy, French, and obviously all the European countries that you mentioned. And in this way, have a chance to get heard.
Right.
Otherwise, you might come back in 10 years and still none of us would have been able to have access to EE. And I think that's possibly the only way to go, to try to persuade everybody who... But it's always the same. If they're not here today, it's because they can't have access to it here. So they probably don't know that you've got so much.
Yeah.
So it's just a question of little by little trying to build up events like that one, so that our colleagues realize how much of the French stuff or German stuff, whatever.
We've got colleagues working on Catherine the Great's correspondence right now, which will be going in to Electronic Enlightenment. Benjamin Franklin's vast collection is going in eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't have all of it in at once, but if we could make a multilingual approach to the university and to other universities like that.
Yes,
it is the biggest problem we face, is trying to get people to understand the complexity and the range of materials that are, you know, that are available. People really don't realize that it may actually touch what they're doing.
And
I mean, Jahl will know that we're talking about interdisciplinarity here absolutely all the time. If that's not it, I wonder what is. But there's nobody there except people from the English department.
Yeah.
Which seems to me very wrong.
And in the meantime, they pay millions to Elsevier.
And we're totally not for profit. I mean, everything we gain from the subscription fees and the purchase fees goes straight back into the project, which allows us to develop more material. And
oh yes, it's understandable. And even if the subscription sounds very expensive to us, we can understand that it is worthwhile. It's just getting our libraries to subscribe.
I thought the interdisciplinarity of thing would make it easier, and sometimes I've heard from OUP that actually it makes it harder, that the French department says no, the English department should pay for it because there's six more English letters and there are French letters, something like that.
Sorry.
I'm afraid a very practical question. I was quite amazed when you said that you were able to identify every unknown person that you ran correspondence with. Well, my problem is I'm currently working on the French Revolution and American in Paris, written in a journal and correspondence during that period in 1793. And I come across many, many ordinary people, as you call them, very unknown people, and I've tried to check on Google and different research programs,
mm-hmm.
and I must say that I've spent a lot of time, and well, I've been totally capable of finding a clue to who those people were. So my question is, how many people work for you?
Myself and a friend. There's two of us at the moment.
Well, you're wonderful. Exceptional.
Yeah. If we just look at people for a second, this is our persons database. There's 10,337 people in there. 10,337 correspondents, either writers, recipients, or people who are both, obviously. The amount of information we have about all of them may in some cases be very, very little, but we've created them as unique human beings. And every so often we run across somebody who is reattributed. That's not a good example because it's a company. But we have 80 instances where we had created an identity for a person, then it turned out that another edition had created an identity for the person. And so we collapse those. We don't lose the original identity. Some of the people, as I say, we have very, very little information, but they are conceptually an identified human being. And we put in as much information as we have. And we continue with each update of material, we search again through all of the people to see if that person is conceivably already in some way, shape, or form. So over the course of time, we gradually identify people, and then I shout out loud because I've identified one person. But
you kind of build up the identity.
Exactly. And with lots of corrections from people like yourselves who email and say, you idiot, that's not who that is, you know, it's somebody else. Sometimes they're quite indignant, but I more than welcome it.
Yes, well, this makes it all the more difficult as sometimes there may be pseudonyms or nicknames.
Exactly.
Right.
We record all the instances and gradually connect them together. So on what I call my aliases layout, I have has real name, has possible name, has spellings, aliases, nicknames, pseudonyms, also known as changed name from to, peerage titles, job titles, and corporate names. So all possible links. And peerage titles, for instance, we're gradually including the dates when they change from Vicomte to something else, etc. Ongoing process.
I think we need several sabbaticals.
My colleague who works with me, Mark, is an extraordinary character. He's he fits into this project, obsessive nature of this project, very well. He was the first person to develop an online hotel reservation system when he was 16 years old and sold it to Hilton Hotels for a mountain bike. As a result of that, the Japanese government sent him to Japan to design their internet infrastructure for the country, and he spent years in Japan and then came back and helped set up a social justice network for women and children in Africa. And now he's working with us while still working with that group as well. But interesting fellow. One of the things he's insisted on is, for instance, little details, but our URL, the address line, is hackable. So if you put in year and 1740, you'll get everything from the year 1740. It's a small thing, but it shows the bibliographic detail, if you will, that lies behind electronic enlightenment. We've been very slow to introduce a lot of fancy visualizations because they can be misleading, and we want to make sure that they work absolutely right when we put that sort of material online.
Further questions?
I am really fascinated by the amount of data that is stored in the EE project. I would like to have an idea about the capacity storage of servers, well, the database, for instance.
Well, we've been running a series of Apple X servers running the database system. They're in a commercial server farm in London. One of those places where you go in just at like a sci-fi movie and it scans your eyes and so on. The current capacity of electronic enlightenment, the whole thing fits on my laptop easily, mainly because the way it's constructed, the data bits are very, very small and then put together with the web engine that we use, which at the moment is PHP. But it is going to have to expand dramatically with the increase in the number of images in particular. So one of the maps, the scalable maps that we have, while the map may start out, we capture all the images as archival quality. So the map starts out at maybe 50 megabytes in size. But a map ends up being something like 2,000 images, pyramided structure of images. And luckily at Oxford, we're able to use colleagues to help us with that sort of thing. We use they call it the supercomputing center. They've got all kinds of different arrays of computers, and we're able to run our images through their systems and split them up and structure them that way. I think the total amount of data probably runs to something like 5 gigabytes at this point. Again, because it's mainly text, it's relatively small, but the images are adding to it quite significantly. We're being approached all the time by different groups. I received an email while I was here, in fact. There's a Great Houses project, which is partly organized by the National Gallery in London. And they want to include electronic enlightenment in the project and will be given access to the letters of the families of the great houses, beginning with Chatsworth and Blenheim. I've also meeting in January with the Queen's archivist because they want to include George III's letters in electronic enlightenment, which is a huge collection of materials.
Going to be one of my questions. What do you how do you decide what's going to go in next? And because I assume you've got many people contacting you, certainly there seems to be an upsurge in correspondence editing, and many people seem to be doing it one way or another. And you're one, but not the only one to deal with letters. So I assume a lot of people get in touch saying, you know, can we include that in the future, etc. So who decides what's going to go in next and in what form? I mean, do you have
We have an editorial board of International Board of Scholars, which you'll find on the website. There's a list of the scholars. I make a presentation saying I think it should probably be this because it connects with that. The Mary Wollstonecraft has moved up the ladder in part because there's a big collection of material in the Bodleian Library deposited by Lord Lytton, and he recently contacted us. The material in the main is Byron correspondence and Ada Lovelace, the great early mathematician who was worked with Babbage on the creation of the first computer, the difference engine. She wrote the first computer algorithm. This material is deposited in the Bodleian under strict restrictions, and they charge academics currently by the word to quote from this material. But he's decided that that's not the way to go forward, and they want to include it in Electronic Enlightenment. Now, that may help bump up some of the material from the Romantic area that is being offered to Electronic Enlightenment. Having said that, many of the offerings are relatively small, so we're getting letters, single letters to tens of letters, and we can help people prepare that material. One of the things we've developed is a word template with style sheets that lets you simply use a style for various structures within the letter, and then we run a conversion, XSLT conversion system on that to convert it into XML. The Mellon, as I mentioned, has come back to us and wants us with colleagues in the university to see if we can develop an online editing system using what other people have worked on, but taking it further. If that works, what we'll be able to do then is provide images of the documents and say to you, for instance, do you have some students that would like to work on editing materials and give them special access to that? So, I mean, to date, we've been sort of taking all comers, but we've sort of over the last year almost seen a significant geometrical increase in the amount of material that's being offered to us. The Elizabeth Montagu letters, between 6,000 and 8,000 letters. It'll take them a long time to edit them, so that's the other side of that sort of thing, is we don't have to worry too much because it'll take them a while to do the material. I mean, the Bernardin Saint-Pierre total count is in the neighborhood of 2,500 letters. They've been working on it for 8 years. And provide us 300 to 400 letters a year, usually. Unfortunately, we have to go through all the detail and check because there's still people they don't identify or people for whom... One of the big problems we have is getting people to understand the difference between text and metadata. So metadata is a unique identifier for a person. Text is all the variant spellings. One of the members of my advisory board was Vice President at Yale, who helped create ECHO. They wanted to connect it to electronic... I wanted to connect it to Electronic Enlightenment till I started looking at their indexing structure, which doesn't really exist. Adam Smith, they have 7 unique identifiers for one person. So if you look up Adam Smith, spelled Adam Smith, you won't find all the entries in ECHO. There's some that are AD.Smith, and they don't interconnect. So we're always having to try and get, when this material's on offer, explain to people, you need to create metadata for us, just some spreadsheets that identify a unique place name, etc. So it takes a while for this material to get prepared. It isn't sort of just shoveling it in en masse. Are people working on, besides Montague, I understand? Lady. Yes. Wardley. Other people working on correspondence as well?
Jefferson's correspondence a little.
Jefferson.
Jefferson's correspondence.
Oh, right.
I took it from various editions, but that's all. Mm-hmm. First part one, my PhD, but some of his letters.
While he was serving in France in particular? Or?
No, it's about the letters he wrote about westward expansion or commerce and all the background to the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Right.
And I'm doing Thomas Brown with the OUP complete work.
Oh, right.
I should say, I'm doing Thomas Brown. I should say, I will be starting on Thomas Brown in a few months.
Right.
I co-edited the correspondence volume. So I suppose the question, something that's not entirely clear to me, is the special relation you might have with OUP, for instance, mm-hmm. because it seems to me, we had a big conference at Queen Mary last July, and editing early modern letters or editing early modern anything at the moment, not going through OUP and Jake and Baker, let's put it like that. Otherwise, you know, there's no EHRC money and there's nothing that comes. So you've got the OUP contract first, then you get your EHRC, etc., etc. So my question was, I mean, do you get, I mean, how do you work with OUP, that would be
it depends very much on the individuals that we're working with, but I have to say we've got some really, really good people that we're working with right now. And I have conversations with editors like Sarah Goldsworthy and so on about content and materials. The Godwin material will go into Electronic Enlightenment.
Right.
That's one of the ones we've negotiated recently. I say negotiated. It's very much like with some of the other presses. They want the opportunity to sell some books before they want it appearing in Electronic Enlightenment. So there's usually a moving wall of time delay before the material is put
but
into
your
the
material, you've got to pay for your subscription anyway if you want to go to have access to Electronic Enlightenment. So it's not as if you're putting their content there free and people could have access to it anyway.
No, but they still have a very old-fashioned notion about waiting for the books on the shelf to clear off before it goes electronic.
And how long
they normally say 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got pending agreements for quite a bit of material that's on that 3-year kind of list.
Yeah, but it's not automatic. You've got to negotiate every series.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Consulting my co-convenience.
Well, we can stop whenever, have
stop
a little break, and then we'll stop. Yeah.
Over the break, and, thank you very much. Thank you again, Robert.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for coming.